Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 12th, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Denny Kahn, probably home brewing's most vocal batch sparging proponent, joins us to give us his side of the sparging debate and to answer some listener questions on the topic. If you're new to home brewing, or if you'd like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts, and you can find our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. We've been talking about brewing software the past few weeks as I've been soliciting your comments, and I've got a lot of those, and I appreciate that. And Andy Sparks and I are going to get together and record a show based on those. Now, Steve Flack of Kent Place Software, creator of Beer Alchemy, which is brewing software for the Mac, is offering a special discount for Basic Brewing Radio listeners. Steve listens to the show and wanted to reach out to our Mac user listeners. Until the end of June, if you purchase Beer Alchemy through the KentPlaceSoftware.com site and use the coupon code BASICBREWING, that's all one word, you'll get 25% off the full price of the software. Now, I'm not getting any kind of a financial benefit from this offer, at least not yet. But it will benefit you as a loyal listener and a Mac user. I'll put the link to KentPlaceSoftware.com on BasicBrewingRadio.com. Now, remember, the coupon code at checkout is BASICBREWING, all one word, and you'll get 25% off until the end of June. And we appreciate Steve Flack for helping us out with that and giving you guys a benefit for being listeners of the show. The American Homebrewers Association is making plans for Big Brew 10 coming up on May 5th. That's where homebrewers around the world brew a selection of recipes simultaneously. They're expecting about 3,000 homebrewers to take part this year. Go to beertown.org for more details on that. And, of course, we should have more about that as time goes by. Now, Denny and I talked for a long time, so I want to keep the email segment fairly short this week, but I do want to get a couple of emails in there. Mike from Aurora, Colorado writes after hearing our interview last week with David Loxton from Y-Yeast and has a question for David. Mike says, I'm primarily a mead maker. I normally give my meads 2 minutes of pure oxygen before yeast pitch. However, my meads are always high gravity, that is 1100 or higher, and I've heard several folks talk about adding additional oxygen after fermentation begins, usually 24 to 36 hours after the onset of active fermentation. Can you comment on this? Is it beneficial to the yeast and to fermentation? Are there any downsides to doing this off flavors, etc.? And here's what David said. David Loxton said, adding oxygen for up to 14 hours after pitching is often recommended. The earlier, the better. Once fermentation begins to produce substantial CO2, oxygen is rapidly purged from the fermenter. Stalled primary fermentations are often restarted by racking, by the slight rousing of the yeast and O2 incorporated during the racking. Latent pure O2 additions may cause unusual ester development and potentially oxidation of the mead. So, if you're going to add more oxygen to high-gravity fermentations, the earlier the better, and before 14 hours into fermentation, according to David Loxton. We appreciate his continued contributions to the show. Bill from Richmond, Virginia, writes, a warning about wasting good beer, homebrew or otherwise, in the name of creating good food. Many of us have, at one time or another, used beer to help give our food some added flavor. Bill says you may want to think twice about it. Not long ago, a fellow homebrewer invited my family over for a seafood boil. As we drank a couple of his homebrews, my friend mentioned he had the remainder of a keg of Sam Adams Boston Ale left over from a party, and it was starting to get a little old and flat. He decided to use it to boil the seafood, so rather than adding a beer or two to the water for the boil, he poured in about 2 gallons of pure beer for the boil, no water. As a test, he prepared an additional batch on the stove in pure water. He dumped seafood, corn, potatoes, etc. in both batches and let them boil a while. The meal was delicious, but here's the important part. Bill says our host organized a blind taste test and none of the guests could perceive a difference between the batches. The beer did very little to change the taste of the food. And Bill concludes, "So I hope your listeners benefit from the same lesson I learned. Don't waste good beer in an effort to make great food. Keep them separate." Well, Bill, I appreciate the note, and I appreciate you're passing on the results of that experiment. And your experiment may have proven that beer's not the best liquid for a seafood boil, but, you know, I wouldn't condemn cooking with beer altogether because of that. Anyone who's poured a porter or two in a kettle of chili can tell you that beer can make a contribution to the flavor of food. And now just check out the holiday meal episode of Basic Brewing Video to see Steve Wilkes work wonders with beer in the kitchen with various recipes. So don't give up on beer as an ingredient yet. Play around with more recipes before making such a dramatic conclusion. But I do appreciate your sharing the story and the results of that experiment, Bill. Now, let's jump right into our chat with Denny Kahn, champion of batch sparging, who spent a few minutes of his Easter Sunday to talk to us. Well, Denny Kahn, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
All right, thank you, James. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
And we ran into each other briefly at NHC down in Orlando, and I fully intended to get with you down there, but we ran out of time and I had to get back, and so our paths never crossed down there. But this is better in a way because we have more time to spend, and it's in a more relaxing atmosphere because I'm in my home and you're in your home, and we can chat a little more easily.
Yeah, I would agree. NHC is a ton of fun, but it may not be the best place for something like this.
Well, you are known as an advocate of batch sparging. Is that safe to say?
That is safe to say. I'm an advocate and a user, kind of like the hair club for men.
Well, there you go. Let's start with the basics. Let's start with the very basics. What is sparging in general before we get into the differences between the two different kinds?
Sparging is, there are some like hairs to be split over the definition, but the basic idea of sparging is to rinse the sugar out of the grain that is left behind after the mash is completed.
So the mash is done, our starches have been converted to sugars, and we have lautered or basically drained the sweet wort out of our grains, and then either as that's happening or afterwards, we need to rinse, and that's what sparging is.
Yes, and need to is, of course, relative because there are people who do no sparge brewing.
Right, if you have a big old mash tun or if you just want to make a small batch with a regular size mash tun.
It's very good. It's a really good technique for real low gravity beers too, like milds and stuff like that. But in that case, you just louder the mash and take what you get and there you go. And sometimes if it's a very high gravity runoff from the mash in a no sparge situation, you may add water to the kettle to water it down. And then there are the other two choices are continuous or what's known as fly, which comes from on-the-fly sparging, and batch sparging. Probably the earliest sparging techniques, obviously when people started brewing, all indication is that there was little, if any, sparging done at all historically. Then people wanting to become more economical and efficient with the raw materials they had at hand would start adding more water to the grain and after they had run it off the first time for a big beer and then take that second run off and make a small beer out of it, a technique that's called party guile. If you combine those two runoffs together, you in effect are doing what batch sparging these days does, where you add water and run it off, you know, the second time and then put that in with your first runoff from the mash. As breweries became more industrialized and economy became an even bigger factor in needing to eke out every last cent of extract from the grain, fly sparging came into being because, all things being equal in a perfectly constructed system, fly sparging, it will be more efficient. Now, that's assuming you have a perfectly constructed system. So, whereas, you know, on a homebrewing scale, if batch sparging maybe costs you 10 cents more in grain, that 10 cents by the time you scale up to a commercial operation makes a whole big bunch of difference.
Give us a little personal history. How did you get into batch sparging, and how did you get so high on it, so to speak?
I found out about it because I read a paper by Ken Schwartz that I believe he presented at NHC in 98 in Portland, if I recall correctly. And I was brewing extract at the time, and he'd written one article about converting I guess partial grain recipes to extract or vice versa. One, something that was going to give me a clue on where to go getting into all grain. And in that, he had a little diagram of how to convert a cooler using a Sure screen, which is like a miniature bazooka screen that used to be very popular and widely used. So I took like a 3 or 4 gallon round Rubbermaid cooler and converted it using the Sure screen and fly sparged a couple batches in my kitchen and made some killer beer, but I thought it was just like a total pain in the butt trying to adjust my runoff speed while I was manually pouring more, because, you know, again, I'm a fairly lazy kind of person, so I didn't want to go to the trouble of setting up a tiered system or anything like that. I was just going to pour the water in and do it. So I actually did a few batches like that. First one I made was an alt. It blew me away. I was hooked on brewing grain right away. I moved on, got a bigger cooler set up, and brewed a couple batches. Again, you know, hand pouring the fly sparge because I just didn't want to spend the extra money and take the extra time for some sort of like gravity fed system or a pump or something like that. And then I ran across another paper of Ken's about batch sparging, and at that point in time he was working up some equations that for a spreadsheet that I believe is still on his website to this day. And I got in touch with him and started trying the batch sparging and shooting him my results, and found that when I was using his grain scale-up factor that he had in the spreadsheet, I was overshooting my gravity every time.
Huh.
And at that point I realized, wait a minute, batch sparging is not inherently less efficient than any other type of sparging. Batch sparging is what you make it. I mean, you get the efficiency of your system no matter what, just like with any other system. And at that point, I was totally hooked on it because it was, for me, easier and cheaper because I didn't need the extra equipment. I didn't need to set up the extra equipment. The beer was tasting fantastic, and my efficiencies were every bit as good as anything that I'd ever seen from anybody who was fly sparging.
Yeah, it's often said that batch sparging is less efficient than fly sparging, but in my comparisons, I've gotten, if not the same, pretty close to the same efficiencies doing one to the other. I mean, a couple weekends ago, I did a porter, and I came out, according to the calculations in Ray Daniels' Designing Great Beers, I came out with an efficiency of 78% doing a batch sparge. So, you know, I'd say that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's darn good, and it's not uncommon for me to be up into the mid-80s.
Wow.
You know, depending on what kind of malt I'm using and what kind of beer I'm making. And see, that's the thing. I think that, again, if you have a perfect fly sparge system, then theoretically, you will get a higher efficiency. The thing is, it's darn hard to devise a perfect fly sparge system that is going to drain those sugars even, or rinse those sugars off, and that's the big difference between fly sparging and batch sparging. In fly sparging, you are gradually rinsing the sugar out of the grain, and it has to be a real even process, because otherwise the water will go through like the path of least resistance, and pull all the sugar out of that section, but then the water will keep going through there and there won't be any more sugar to pull. And, you know, that's channeling. Whereas in batch sparging, what you're doing is draining the sugar by getting it all into solution in that water at one time and then just draining it off.
So if you have a poorly designed fly sparge system, you could be worse off than if you've got a batch sparge.
Yeah, there's a guy in our homebrew club who has a beautiful Herms system that he built. It's you know, even though I'm a cheap and easy guy, I still drool at his system. And when I went over and showed him how to batch sparge, his efficiency went up 15 points.
Wow.
You know, and it's just because the lautering system in his, you know, was real inefficient. And in general, you know, batch sparging kind of removes that, the design of your lautering system as a variable.
So what are the mechanics going on in there? I mean, compare the mechanics of what is going on with fly sparge and with a batch sparge. First of all, with a fly sparge, you've got to worry about your gravity getting below 10-10 or your pH getting below it, or is it below or above a certain point?
Above. And that's because the grains have the ability to buffer the pH and reduce it, especially if you have, you know, like any kind of dark grain. If you're doing an all pills mash, then that won't be true. But generally anything with pale malt, crystal, any of the darker grains, they'll be automatically pulling the pH down for you. But in a fly sparge, as you add more and more and more water all the time, you are gradually diluting the buffering power that those grains have, right? So that's then causing the pH to rise closer to what the pH of the water is, because the grains can't pull it down as much. In batch sparging, because you add all the water at once, that figure remains constant. And believe me, when I started batch sparging, I was as skeptical as many other people are. And so probably for the first 15 batches I did, I would check both the pH and gravity throughout the runoff, both of the mash and the sparge, just because I couldn't believe it. And what I found was that they were consistent all the way through.
So why does that happen?
That happens because you're not continually diluting the buffering power of the grain. The water is going in there all at once.
So it's all at once and you drain it out, and then all at once and you drain it out.
Yeah.
And there's not that continuous trickle sort of water coming through there.
Yeah, and especially because of the pressure gradients in a fly sparge of having the heavier sugars at the bottom and stuff like that, you're going to get more dilution at the top than you are at the bottom. And, you know, to tell you the truth, you'd have to talk to John Palmer to get much more on the dynamics of it. I'm more of a, it works, and I know that it works because of this kind of guy.
Well, I think we all rely on John for a lot of the
Oh, boy, do we ever, yeah.
So I guess we should mention that the reason you don't want your pH to rise or your gravity to fall is because you'll be extracting astringent tannin off flavors from your grains.
It puts you at risk of that. It's not a guarantee by any means. People, you know, are very hung up about their sparge temperature also, and it, you know, it's a good thing to be careful of. But a high temperature alone will not put you at risk of tannin extraction. You need both the high temperature and the high pH in order to really have much of a risk of that, not to mention then having, say, the husks of your grain shredded finely enough to make the tannins available. While I always advocate taking precautions and being careful, beer is remarkably forgiving, and you can do a lot of stuff you thought would kill you, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, I found out, in doing this program over the past 90-some-odd weeks, I've discovered a lot of things that I should have been doing a little better, you know, but I'm still getting good beer, so.
Right, you know, and you know, little things can make a difference sometimes, and sometimes they don't make any difference. And experience leads you to figure out what that is.
Yeah, a lot of times it's during the troubleshooting phase that you find out you're doing something wrong, And maybe that's the way it should be.
By programs like yours, by internet discussion forums and stuff, you read about something that somebody's doing that seems to make sense to you, and you give it a try, and you go, hey, that little thing there that I just learned made my beer a whole lot better. Sometimes you go, hey, that little thing I just learned there doesn't make any difference at all to the way I make beer.
Yeah. I was thinking the other day, I was talking to Charlie Talley, I think it was, about Star San and about using bleach in sanitizing equipment. And he said a lot of times people use bleach wrong, but they do so well in cleaning that they're essentially sanitizing in the cleaning step, and when they're using bleach, it's not doing any good at all, but it's not doing any harm. So,
right.
I came up with the thing in my head. It's kind of like, I wave a chicken bone over my fermenter every time I make a beer, and that's what makes my beer good, you know?
Right, yeah. Dan Listerman has a saying that malted barley wants to become beer. And I really believe that that's true, you know?
And Dan is an advocate of fly sparging.
Yes, he is. Oh, so, we've had many discussions about it, you know. That's fine. People get way too hung up. I saw somebody the other day on one of the brewing forums post that they had a bumper sticker that said, "Real men fly sparge." And I thought, man, you were taking this thing way too seriously.
And the one person a day that sees that bumper sticker that it means something to, you know.
Yeah, right. I see these big arguments start about, you know, which is better, fly sparging or batch sparging? Well, which one is better is the one that works best for you.
Yeah.
And basically, if you're doing one and it's not working for you, or the other one sounds interesting, try it and make up your own mind. The fact is they both work great.
And the truth be told, sometimes fly sparging makes better sense to me because, say, if I'm doing a big beer, and most of the wort is going to come out during that first run, it makes sense to me to just sparge. If I'm just going to be sparging like a gallon,
right?
Then a fly sparge makes more sense.
Oh, of course, sure. I mean, and again, you know, that's the practicality part of the whole thing. I mean, you know, and that's what I like about batch sparging, is it seemed more practical to me. But believe me, I've done exactly what you're saying at times, because that seems the practical way to do it.
And you said you've got a webpage that I want to link to called Cheap and Easy Batch Sparge Brewing. In there, you talk about the ratios of sparge water that you want to use in your first sparging, or your first louder, and then your batch sparge. Talk about that a little bit.
This is all based on work that other people have done, fortunately, that I've been able to pick up on. Most notably, again, Ken Schwartz. Although I learned a lot about batch sparging both from Bob Regent and George Fix, but you know, Ken has worked up some equations that show that you will get your best efficiency if the two runoffs from your mash are equal volumes. So what ideally you want to try and do, I mean, I generally mash with about 1 1/3 quarts per pound, because it gets me pretty darn close to getting half of my total boil volume from that first mash runoff without having to add any additional water first. Today, I was going for a 7.5-gallon boil. I was using 16.5 pounds of grain, I believe. And I got 3 1/4 gallons out of my mash tun, and then the rest from my sparge. So, you know, I'm pretty darn close to half of it, and that's with the 1.33 quarts per pound ratio. So then I added about 3.75 gallons of sparge water, ran that through, and was right at my boil volume. Now, in truth, what I've found is that it isn't going to make a world of difference if you're off somewhat. generally, if I anticipate my mash runoff to be within, say, a gallon of what I would need for it to be half, I don't mess with it. You know, again, it's, you know, being cheap, being easy, you know. So in that case, I will just add more sparge water and get what I need that way. I can't say that I've ever seen it make a real consistent difference in efficiency. On the other hand, if I anticipate my mash runoff to be farther off in volume than that, at the end of the mash, after conversion is complete, before I do runoff, I'll add enough extra water to get me up to what I think is going to be about half of my total boil volume. And I'll probably, you know, that may be like in the neighborhood of a gallon, gallon and a half of water. And I'll probably use boiling water to get up as close to a mash out temp as I can, and chances are even that won't get me there. So
if your ratios are such that it accommodates it or doesn't accommodate it, do you skip the mash out?
Oh, sure. Yes. You know, theoretically, a mash out has two purposes. One is to reduce the viscosity of the wort by raising the temperature so that it flows a little bit more easily and theoretically may impact your efficiency a point or two. The other purpose of a mash out is to denature the enzymes to stop conversion so that, you know, your mash isn't still converting. Now, in truth, very few home brewers do a mash out at a high enough temperature for a high enough time to denature the enzymes. You'd need to hold it for, say, at least 10 minutes at 170 or so to do that. And most home brewers I know who try to do mash outs don't do that. The other thing is, in batch sparging, the time from the mash tun to the boil is so short relatively that, you know, the boil is going to denature those enzymes. So, you know, a mash out becomes much less important in batch sparging in terms of the enzyme denaturing. I think I might be able to say that I've seen it make a point or so difference in my efficiency, but, you know, that's within the accuracy of your measurement, and so I would hate for anybody to think that a mash out is really a crucial step. It can't hurt. I mean, again, it's never going to hurt, but that's why I say, you know, I shoot for it. If I don't make it, it's not going to make a huge difference. And again, I'm speaking in terms of the equipment I use and the beers I brew.
Your mileage.
I don't brew a lot of beers that are heavy on wheat, where a mash out may help more. But again, I have brewed beers that are heavy on wheat and not found a mash out to make a significant difference. If you're using a different type of lautering system, a false bottom or something like that, a mash out may make more sense for you. With the toilet hose braid that I use, it doesn't seem to matter.
I use one of those too.
Yeah. Looks great, huh, man?
Yeah, it sure does.
I just hit batch number 280 with it today with the same cooler and hose braid.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
One more question along those lines. You said something that triggered this. Since you're running the wort out so fast in a batch sparge, is there a higher danger of getting a stuck louder or a stuck sparge?
Not with my system. That's all I can tell you. I mean, I've seen it happen. I mean, and the thing is, you don't have to run off fast, and I guess this is a good time to clarify that, because I do get emails from people who say, 3 minutes is as fast as I can run off. Is that okay? And it's like, yeah, man, that's way cool. But running off fast is not a requirement. The thing is that with fly sparging, due to the nature of the rinsing of the sugar, you pretty much need to take a reasonable amount of time and go slow to do that. With batch sparging, because you are draining the sugars and not rinsing them, you can sparge as fast as your system will allow. And that's the important point right there. As fast as your system will allow.
I always go moderately slowly, just because I'm thinking that, you know, the longer that the grains have to soak in the – I do a mash out. So I'm thinking the longer the grains have to soak in that hotter water, maybe it's extracting more sugars.
You'd think that, wouldn't you, James?
I don't – that's what I think.
You'd be wrong because I tried that.
Well, there you go.
Because I thought that that was the truth also. Okay. Just because in some of these emails you forwarded me, the time issue has come up. I timed myself today, and I was not hurrying. I was working at my normal pace, right? From the time I began my first runoff till the time I had all the wort, 7.5 gallons of wort, in the kettle, including the time to write all this down, was 15 minutes.
Wow.
My first runoff, I vorloffed 1 quart, and it took me 65 seconds, including returning it to the mash tun, and then 6 minutes total to run off that 3.5 gallons. Then to add another 3.75 gallons, stir it in, recirculate, and run it off again took about another 9 minutes. And I got 79% efficiency today.
Well, you mentioned the emails, and this all started from an email from Kim from Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
I love Calgary.
I've never been there. I've never been.
I used to be a rock and roll roadie, and I was on tour, and we stopped in Calgary many years ago. Had a great time there.
Any big names that we'd know?
Only if you're as old as I am. It was a band from New Zealand called Split Enz that later went on to become Crowded House.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I love Crowded House.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tim and Neil Finn and those guys, yeah.
Yeah, that's, well, that's great.
Yep, I spent about 3 years working for them.
Yeah, I may be older than you think.
Well, it's nice to know I'm not alone.
But we digress.
Yes, we do.
Kim says, I'd like someone in the hobby to sort out exactly what exactly the differences are between a batch sparge and a fly sparge and a fast fly sparge in terms of time, effort, grain efficiency, and hassle. A lot of people in the hobby are sold on batch sparging, saying it's faster, less work, same efficiency, no more tannin extraction, etc. I call BS, he says. If batch sparging was so great, wouldn't the commercial breweries use it? That's the first part.
Yeah, I know. I always love that part. Kim, I got to tell you that the way I look at it is I'm a home brewer. I'm not a commercial brewer, and so I'm freed from the constraints they have. I guess earlier I kind of addressed a little bit about why commercial breweries don't use it, because they have to eke out every last cent from their brewing, and on the scale that they're brewing, it just wouldn't be economically feasible. But a point that I'd like to make is that as much as we can learn from what commercial brewers do, that's no reason to think that what they do should be the way we do things. Take the lessons, but think for yourself.
We also have a letter from John Palmer, who we mentioned before, saying the reason that microbreweries on up don't batch sparge is because the energy and time intensive to heat up 7+ barrels of water and pump it into the main mash tun and drain. At the professional scale, it's faster and more energy efficient to do the processes more in parallel, i.e. louder continuously and send the wort to the boiler to start getting it hot, rather than take 2 hours to batch sparge and another 2 hours to bring all that wort to a boil, etc.
Right. So once again, you come to two considerations: economic, right? It's cheaper for them to fly sparge, and equipment. They have the equipment to fly sparge, right? Because it is an economic incentive for them. For me, I'm a lazy guy. Cheap and easy. That's what it is. I don't want to have to. I mean, I have better things to spend my money on than a pump. Although the older I get, the more a pump comes into my life.
But that's
another story. I don't want to have to like set up vessels up high and fill them with hot water and let them drain by gravity and all that stuff when it's so easy for me. I mean, The other thing is that I came into the hobby of brewing from cooking as a hobby since I was about 12 years old. And I really enjoy brewing the same way I cook, which is hands-on. You know, just like I don't feel like I need to cook like a commercial restaurant, I don't feel like I need to brew like a commercial brewery.
Well, Kim has four more points. He says, I don't think it's much faster. I think some people overdo how slowly they fly sparge. By the time one fills the mash vessel, stirs it, lets it settle, circulates it a bit, and drains it, all done two or three times per batch, one could probably do a fly sparge. And I guess you've probably already answered that.
Yeah, well, I've seen people who take batch sparging to extremes, and in an effort to eke out every last efficiency, will do three or four or even more batch sparges. And boy, you know, if you're like that, then you need to be fly sparging instead. or you've got your own technique, and I'm glad that it works for you. There are some people who make, you know, batches big enough they need to do like multiple batch sparges, and it takes them a long time. Well, my solution to that was, for big batches, I went out and got a 152-quart cooler, and I get 75 pounds of grain in it, do one batch sparge, and get 10 gallons of a 100-gravity beer out of it.
Wow.
So if you're doing a lot of batches when you batch sparge, you need to consider if it's really worth it to you to do that, and if maybe you need to upgrade your equipment, or think about, you know, coming up with a different technique that might be better for you. Or, yeah, like I said, who knows, maybe you've invented something new that works great.
Point number three by now, I don't think it's less work. It takes more stirring and circulating than a fly sparge does, generally more attention than a fly sparge, which just involves running water.
For me, again, the fly sparge took me being able to equilibrate the inflow and outflow of the mash tun, and I've learned a lot about it since then. I mean, there are people who kind of do combo batch and fly sparges by pouring in a lot of fly sparge water at a time and not worry about maintaining the perfect water level and stuff, and I guess that works pretty well also. I hear this all the time. People say, you know, boy, I don't know how you can say it's less work. You know, I boil off 3 gallons and it takes me 20 minutes and everything, and it's like I'm going, I'm sorry, like I said, I just voiloffed a quart today and it took me 65 seconds.
Yeah, I think I've been over voiloffing because my wort clears pretty quickly, and I'm thinking, well, surely there's got to be more than that. Let me run it through a few more times.
You know, James, if there's no chunks in it, you're good to go. And the great thing about using those braids, and you know, I say this not because I get kickbacks from the toilet hose braid industry, but the great thing about those braids is I brewed side by side with people using false bottoms and manifolds, and then me with my braid, and consistently the wort clears faster using that braid than it does with either a false bottom or a manifold.
And talking about the work issue, when I do fly sparge on the big scale, you know, I set up my own little triple tier system, putting the brew kettle in the ground, and then my mash tun on a little table, and then on the big table I have on a table on top of the table. In fact, I have my hot liquor tank, which is my bottling bucket, and so I have to climb a step ladder to get up on top of there to pour 170 degree water up there in that top. And to me, that's work.
Tell me, man, and I am the clumsiest person in the world. I mean, I guarantee you that if I was doing that, I would have poured that water on myself more than once by this point in my life.
And if you pour your sparge water into your mash tun, it's going to stir itself up automatically.
Depends on the method. I still find that stirring makes a lot of difference.
Hmm.
I know that there are people out there who don't stir their sparge, and they seem to be getting great efficiencies, and that is absolutely cool. I'm really glad to hear that. For me, it just doesn't work that way. I find that my efficiency is consistently a few points better when I stir, and so what? It's taken me an extra 15 seconds. That's not a big part of my brew day, you know. So the one thing that I should mention to people who have looked at my webpage that I haven't changed, that does need to be changed, is that I used to say that when you put in that sparge water, you stir it in and you wait 10 minutes before you start recirculating. That is totally unnecessary, I've discovered. I've now poured that sparge water in, I stir it up, I whirl off, and I run off.
Yeah, it doesn't take long to settle like that.
No, I mean, for some reason, you know, I used to have this feeling because of something I'd read once, kind of like you did about, you know, if you let the water sit in there longer, you might get more sugars or something. So I would, you know, pour in the sparge water, stir it in, let it sit for 10 minutes before I did anything else, and then go. And then I realized, wait a minute, conversion is complete. The purpose is to get the sugars into the water. There is absolutely no reason. And people say, well, let your grain bed settle a little bit better. And I guess depending on what kind of loadering system you have, that might make a difference. With the braid, again, it clears so quickly. I think it took me 2 quarts instead of one, you know, after I stir. So not a significant factor for me.
The next point, if batch sparging is faster, wouldn't a fast fly sparge yield the same thing? And I'm not sure what he's calling a fast fly sparge here.
I would assume that he means just running the water in on top as fast as you could while you ran it out the bottom at the same rate. I mean, let's assume that that's what he means.
Okay.
In which case, the answer is no, it wouldn't, because of the dynamics of the water flow, like we discussed earlier in the possibility of channeling and stuff like that. And again, this is a place where I would refer you to the appendices of How to Brew, where John does the study of dynamics in a Lauterton.
One would think, again, if you're running the water through fast, it's going to want to be encouraged to channel more, maybe.
Exactly, and that's the thing. It's going to find the path of least resistance in your loudering system because, right, we're assuming that no matter how good your loudering system is, it isn't perfect and it isn't even over the floor of the mash tun. So the water is going to find the path of least resistance, go straight down through the grain there, pull out the sugar, but then the water will keep flowing through there without pulling much more sugar with it.
And the one last point, which I think we answered in the first, how can the mash be made as thin as it is with a batch sparge and not yield more tannin extraction?
Yeah, and for that I would say that a batch sparge mash really is no thinner than a fly sparge mash. You pretty much mash with whatever ratio you like. Any thinning, like through multiple water additions for a mash out or to even the runoff, is done after conversion happens and is not really going to have an impact on tannins.
And with a fly sparge, over time, since you're putting fresh water at the top, you are thinning out the wort that comes through there.
Right.
But with a batch sparge, all the wort that's in the mash tun at that time is the same density, right?
Each running is the same gravity, you know. And again, this is kind of what they discovered back in the old days with the party guile brewing, is that, you know, you get like I think it's generally around 60% of the available sugar the first runoff, 60% of what's left the next time, 60% of what's left the time after that. So then, you know, that's what people who do the multiple batch sparges are doing. And that's why even with batch sparging, you're not immune from over sparging if you do something like that. You have to be sensible about it.
And you know what Elvis Costello said?
What was that?
He said, you're nothing but a party guile. So,
ooh, touche, buddy. I like that.
You proved your age.
Yeah, that's true. I love Elvis.
Yeah, I do too. There are a couple more emails, one from each side of the fence, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Rich from Colorado says, I wanted to respond to your comments on fly sparging versus batch sparging. He writes, I've always done batch sparging, but I think he meant fly sparging. So let's just say that. I've always done fly sparging. I can't imagine doing it any differently. Once I boil off, I can let the sparge run, and I can take care of other brew day chores. I've never worried about tannin extraction, and my sparges always end with a wort much higher than 10-10. I don't think there would be much time saved by batch sparging, and anyway, fly sparging makes my brew day more fun. Well, if you know, if it makes your brew day more fun, then that's what you should do.
What else is the purpose, Rich? You know, batch sparging makes my brew day more fun. That's why I do it. But I'm not about to tell you how to do your own.
Yeah.
And there's a guy in our club who would agree with you, who has been making beers much longer than I have, and has the most amazing beer recipe formulation mind I've ever seen. And he generally brews 3 10-gallon batches simultaneously when he brews.
Wow.
And he said he tried batch sparging and it went too fast. And he couldn't get all the other stuff done that he had to do in the other batches. And so it's like, whatever works for you, man, I'm not going to argue with your results.
Yeah, and that's the one I use. I love Listerman's little sparge arm thing.
Yeah.
Little twirly thing.
The whirly gig?
Yeah. I did find out that once I got the output and the input balanced on the sparging thing, I could go off and start sanitizing or, you know, doing whatever. So there is something to that.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, I can do that with my batch sparging, too. I mean, like I said, during my 15 minutes total sparge, I spent about 2 minutes doing the actual Vorloff part, and the rest of it was just waiting for the mash tun to drain. Or I guess it took maybe like about 3 minutes to add water manually. But, you know, so then I've got the time where the mash tun drain. I mean, you know, I don't have any trouble not only getting all my other brewing chores done while this is going on, but generally vacuuming the house and doing the laundry, too, so my wife gets to stay in the garden. That's what makes brewing really fun.
There you go. She gets to stay in the garden, and you get to stay by the brew
kettle. That's right, man. You know, I'm out in the garage. I'll do a step. I'll run in the house, do some housework. You know, let me tell you, the beer bullets you earn are amazing.
You are a wise man. The last one here from Drew in Skiesville, Maryland. In response to the batch sparge versus fly sparge debate, my two cents are as follows. I don't think any one method is better than the other. For me, it was the simplicity of batch sparging that got me into all-grain brewing. To make the step into all-grain, it took a minimal amount of extra equipment to do batch sparging. I agree it does save some time on brew day, but if time was the factor, then I would have remained an extract brewer. I can't comment on the efficiency of extraction since I have not fly sparged, but I'm happy with my 67%, and I base my recipes around that.
Drew is a wise man. I mean, I that first sentence, you know, I don't think there's any one method that's better than the other, and I would agree. I mean, inherently, there is nothing about either method that makes it better. It's what works the best for you. This is a hobby. We're in it to have fun and to make good beer at the same time, and if one method does better for you at that than the other, then that's the method that you should be doing. I do know from the hundreds of emails I've gotten from people that there are a lot of people who wouldn't be all-grain brewing like Drew if it wasn't for batch sparging because they found it so easy, or quite a few who were frustrated with fly sparging and tried batch sparging, and, you know, that really hooked them. Again, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with fly sparging, but boy, as far as I'm concerned, anything that makes more people want to get into brewing and makes them have more fun doing it while they're making great beer, that's a good thing.
There shouldn't be animosity between the two camps.
Bill Pierce, a very wise man, has said, hey, it's just rinsing the sugar from the grain. And that is really the attitude. You know, I mean, I like to joke and say, you know, fly sparging, it's not just a technique, it's a religion, you know, things like that. But in truth, you know, home brewing is all about having fun, making good beer and getting together with your friends to enjoy it. And whatever method works the best for you is great. People just need to be aware that batch sparging is a real viable alternative to do that.
Well, Denny, I sure appreciate your time.
Why, thank you very much, James. Have just a wonderful Easter dinner with your family.
Thank you, sir. Well, thanks again to Denny Kahn. I'll put a link to his cheap and easy batch sparging page in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. And we look forward to seeing Denny in Denver at the National Homebrewing Conference in June. And, of course, I misquoted Elvis Costello. The line goes, they say you're nothing but a party girl or party guile. You'd think after hearing that song about 5 million times, I'd remember that. Next week, I hope to have Chris Colby from BYO Magazine talk about IPAs, English and American. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In our first DVD, Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process, step by step, from boiling to bottling. And in our second DVD, Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And we actually show you the processes of batch sparging and fly sparging, both. And we walk you through those, and you can make your own decision as to which one you like better. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online. So thanks to everybody also who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Slow Cooker Ready and Waiting, 160 sumptuous meals that cook themselves, and Columbia Ice Crest 3-person dome tent. Sounds like some camping going to be doing this summer. Sounds great. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy in Austin, Kelly Dodson, who also did our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.